for great-looking t-shirts, hoodies, and sweatshirts, the TNT Shop is now open at tntradio.live. You're listening to Scott Wheeler and Through the Looking Glass on today's News Talk, TNT Radio.
Hello and welcome to Through the Looking Glass. We have got some pretty powerful information for you this hour, and we will be bringing on our expert witness in just a second. For the moment, we have, let's set the stage. Of course, everyone knows we had an election in the United States this week, and there is still problems and things seeming to go wrong with what we've got, what's happening in the United States with the election count. We're going to cover more of that next week as we'll have more information. But right now, we are going to talk about something that was happening in another part of the world, and that is the UN Climate Summit. And there were some very interesting things coming out of the UN Climate Summit that should shock and surprise everyone. But first, consider, just in September, the World Bank boasted that it had delivered a record $31.7 billion this year to help countries address climate change, a 19% increase over the previous fiscal year. Quoting the World Bank President David Malpass, in our last fiscal year ending June 2022, we provided a record $31.7 billion to countries to identify and enable high-priority climate-related projects as part of their development plans, unquote, said David Malpass, president of the World Bank. We will continue providing solutions to pool funding from the global community for impactful and scalable projects that reduce GHG, greenhouse gas emissions. The U.S. government has spent hundreds of billions of dollars over the past 40 years to convince Americans that there is a climate crisis. That is staggering, to convince hundreds of billions of dollars to convince people that there is a climate crisis. And many of you have seen it all right in front of you. And we now are going to bring in our expert witness. Scientist Gregory Whitestone has devoted a lot of his life to teaching people that there is no climate crisis. Mr. Whitestone is a geologist, has a BS and MS in geology. He's a best-selling author of the book Inconvenient Facts and an expert reviewer of the Intergovernmental Panel on Climate Change. That's why we bring him today to talk about what happened in the UN. Mr. Whitestone, thank you so much for joining us. A lot to unpack, no?
Good to be on with you, Scott. There is a lot to unpack here. But let's just back to something you said there. One of the directors of Goldman Sachs just last week reported in an interview, he reported that it was $3.7 trillion has been spent over the last 10 years to in support of renewables, almost $4 trillion of spending. And let's think about that. 2021, we were using fossil fuels accounted for 81% of world energy. All right. 10 years ago, it was at 82%. So we've spent nearly $4 trillion on renewables that barely budged the amount of percentage of what their use is in the world. It's incredible. We're wasting incredible amounts of money chasing solutions to a non-existent problem.
So basically, there's two arms of this, of these expenditures. One is the amount of money that is allocated to convincing people that there is a problem. And then there is the other component to it, which is spending money to try and lower the CO2 emissions, which, as you just pointed out, Mr. Wrightstone, it essentially is not working. It hasn't done anything. And I think you and many others have pointed out over the years that the efforts, U.S. government political leaders say is going to save the planet, really is not moving the needle much at all.
Not at all. And we have to also look here at the CO2 Coalition. We've more than 100 of the top scientists and experts in the world working on this. And we all subscribe to the notion that what they're calling the demon molecule, carbon dioxide or CO2, we call the miracle molecule. We see that more CO2 is hugely beneficial. We see that the modest warming, it's warmed about 0.8 of a degree since 1900. That's not too alarming to me, but it has warmed. That modest warming combined with increasing CO2 is having huge benefits to our ecosystems, to agriculture, and to the human condition. We should celebrate that. But instead, they're making up stories and complete fictionalized accounts of what might happen by the year 2100. What's going to happen in 80 years is what they're warning us, or 2050. But yet, if we look at what's actually happening, I'm a real world kind of guy. I look at what's actually happening today. And let's take a look at it. By almost every metric we look at, life is getting better. Ecosystems are better. Forest fires aren't at record lows. We can go through some of these in detail, but forest fires were about 20% of what we were 90 years ago. But you wouldn't know it listening to the media. They tell us that hurricanes, every hurricane that makes landfall, it's unprecedented. It's never happened before. But yet, landfalling hurricanes, we see it around the world in the United States. And that's the best metric to use for hurricanes is landfalling hurricanes, because we know every single landfalling hurricane, going back to the year 1850, maybe a little bit before, and we know that the number of landfalling hurricanes has declined. We know that definitely tornadoes and large tornadoes, again, over many decades, have been declining. Severe weather events have declined 10% since the year 2000. They're not increasing. And we know that the biggest statistic of all is the number of deaths related to extreme weather. We've seen a 98% decline since the early 1900s. Now, a lot of that has to do with better warning system. That's probably the bulk of it. You know, oh my gosh, there's a tornado. You know, tornadoes are likely. Go to the basement. They didn't have that back in the 20s and 30s and 40s. We're able to predict hurricanes with greater accuracy. They can't say exactly where they're going. They don't have that down. But we know days ahead of time, it's going to be a big hurricane that's going to get out of the way, and everybody bails out. And by the way, Scott, if you had a 2021 Tesla with a full charge, and you lived in, let's just say, Sarasota, and you had a full charge, and then next to it was your 2015 Toyota Corolla internal combustion engine, which car are you going to use to flee the storm? It's going to be the Corolla with a gas tank full of gas, because you're going to be probably moving at 5 or 8 miles an hour, and that battery is going to die about, you know, 100 miles, 150 miles from where you want to get to.
And you have a lot better chance of being able to find fuel if you're leaving in a hurricane zone or where a hurricane is about to hit.
No doubt. And then that's compounded if we have lots more electric vehicles. Think what they're going to do. Let's say we're having an evacuation. You've got 1.8 million people fleeing the storm up I-95. Well, you're going to have, if we just increase the electric vehicles, think about the wait to get your car charged. You know, each one takes, 30 or 45 minutes at a fast charge. And now you've got many thousands of vehicles to getting that charge. And the other thing we look at with the electric vehicles, they don't work very well in really cold weather or actually really hot weather. The battery efficiency really degrades.
It degrades. And then when you have these vehicles that strand on the freeway, they're stranded. There's no mobile electric truck. You can have a gas truck come out and refuel vehicles on the freeway. You can't bring out a mobile electric truck to do that. And so if they stall, then suddenly the exit throughways become blocked and no one can go anywhere.
Yeah.
And so I
know we're going a little bit far afield here from the COP27 in Egypt, but electric vehicles are really a big part of the big climate change story. And that's what they want us to drive. And Scott, my greatest fear, and I've been talking a lot about this, these lithium batteries are somewhat unstable, especially during charging, that, and they tend to ignite without warning. At some point, there's going to be one of these electric vehicles parked in an underground garage, say right below me in my apartment building. Well, what happens when one of these catches on fire? You can't hardly put them out. The normal thing to do with an electric vehicle fire is just let it burn out. What's that going to happen if it's underneath the building and the fumes are incredibly toxic? That's a nightmare scenario that I fear might play out at some point in the future.
So we normally you would expect that somebody is paying attention to this inside this movement away from fossil fuels. Somebody is watching all of these different contingencies and planning for it. But what we've seen, especially from our federal government, no one really is. In fact, they keep pushing the same alarmist agenda while at the same time the data and the science don't track with what they claim is happening. We've now, you know, they've been on this elliptical roller coaster constantly for almost 40 years. And they, you know, we're hearing we've got 10 years left. And at the same time, if that were true, nothing that they seem to be doing would change anything anyway. And so we basically have 10 years left. Why even bother? I mean, using their own logic.
Well, I'm revisiting my book, Inconvenient Facts. It was published 5 years ago. I'm updating it. And it's kind of fun going through what people had said back in 1990. I had a portion of my book on tipping points, and everybody was calling 400 parts per million the tipping point. That once we got to that, there was no returning. Well, we're at approaching 420 right now, 420 parts per million. And we see nothing but good coming from more CO2. So, you know, they keep moving their goalposts. And one of the problems they have is, you know, AOC a few years ago said, well, we only have, which I think she said 10 years. What is it, 7 years now?
Seven years left. These goalposts, now, yeah.
Yeah, they set these goalposts. They need to put them way in the future so they'll never get there. There's a whole series of their predictions they've made. But what's funny now, well, actually, it's not funny, it's scary, is what we're hearing coming out of the COP27, which is the taking place in Sharm el-Sheikh, Egypt, their yearly meeting on climate change. Biden just was there yesterday and delivered an address. We're hearing a lot of deranged commentary and projections coming out. We saw John Kerry shaking the hand of Maduro, the former Venezuelan leader. He's got an $8 million bounty on his head. They were chumming it up. I guess he's a buddy of John Kerry's now. We saw that these people are saying things out loud that we have all suspected. And Scott, as the leader of the CO2 coalition, we as a group try to stick to the science as much as possible. And it's difficult with a highly charged and politicized subject like climate change, but we do try and do that. And I do lots of interviews, and invariably at some point in the interview, you know, we've talked through all these things with how the climate alarm and climate industrial complex is peddling falsehoods. And at some point the host usually says, well, why are they doing it? Basically, why are they lying to us? And I always turn it around and say, you know, what do you think? Because I stick to the science. Well, John Kerry, and the rest of these people in the World Economic Forum have now said out loud, and actually Greta Thunberg last week, they've said out loud what we've suspected all along. And that is that this isn't really an environmental effort. It's an anti-capitalist remaking of the world economic system. This is what they're after. And they're finally saying it out loud. John Kerry just yesterday admitted that the climate change agenda was modeled on efforts to roll out the vaccine during COVID. He came out and said that, and that this was just, this is what they're going to use as a model to get us to conform. You will conform or else. They're doing this. And again, they're saying things out loud that most of us, and I suspect you have suspected, is that Greta Thunberg last week, she said that this is really not about environmentalism. It's about that they need to destroy capitalism and start over with something fresh. Whatever that fresh thing is, I suspect it's going to start with Marx and end in ism, whatever it might be. And there's a, it's, and we're seeing this too. Again, the World Economic Forum is playing a big role here. And they're cutting back funding, particularly Africa is wonderful, wonderful. The African nations are finally standing up and saying no to this radical anti-fossil fuel movement, because Africa and around the world, we see billions of people living in energy poverty. They're cooking over dried dung and wood inside their homes because they don't have any electricity. 600 million people in India alone are without electricity. What they need is electricity, not from solar power or wind. They need coal-fired electricity, and that's what they're doing. China in particular is building huge numbers of coal-fired plants, and only followed by India and Brazil. And that's their desire. They want to lift these people out of generational poverty. I'm not sure that's the motive for China. I think it is for India. Prime Minister Modi there, I think, is a good man. And he does want to lift these people up out of generational poverty. But China might have ulterior motives. They just want to dominate the world as the number one economic power. And they do that with using electricity and energy. There are three words that I use for energy like that. And it's reliable, abundant, and affordable. And that ain't solar, and that ain't wind. It's possibly nuclear is reliable and abundant, not so much affordable, but coal and natural gas in particular are these reliable, abundant, affordable energy choices.
You mentioned that the people pushing this idea of remaking the economy, the global economy. Has there been any consideration that you've seen in how it would actually, in order to remake the global economy in any fashion, would except returning to the Stone Age, would cause a more drain on resources and cause more CO2 in the environment than we have now, since the system is there and it can be managed? Restarting everything doesn't make any sense, does it? Unless there is this belief that we can go back, that most of the world, of course, the ruling class never considers itself to be subject to these diktats, but for the rest of the world to go back to the Stone Age and for them to live well on what minimal resources are produced. Go ahead. Yeah.
I think the great danger here is really it's to the economies of the world and to the people themselves, because what they're doing and their ideas are intentionally increasing energy costs for all of us. And they pretend to care about the poor and the little persons, and they want to put it to the man, the corporations. But yet their policies are intended and will hurt the poorest among us, those on fixed incomes, those living in poverty, because those people pay higher percentage of their incomes on energy compared to higher income people. So they're going to be hurt the worst. It might not cost. If you have, you know, if somebody's, we've seen a tripling of electricity prices just between July and August. And I got a bill from New Hampshire. They're costing, particularly New England, we can talk a little about in a bit. They're a special case, but their electricity costs tripled in 1 month when their electricity, and they're holding back on and having people pay that, and they're subsidizing it, but they're going to have to, it's going to come to every consumer. You're going to see your electricity bills, but just think about this. Maybe you or I could afford $1,800 extra a month or a year for electricity, for heating, but not so those struggling to meet day to day. And maybe you are, I don't know, but those struggling just to pay bills day by day, they can't afford another $1,800 or $2,800 or whatever it might be. And they don't, the ruling elites don't seem to care.
We're speaking with Gregory Wrightstone. He is the author of the book, Inconvenient Facts, and he's the executive director of the CO2 Coalition, which promotes the idea that CO2 is good for the environment and good for vegetation to grow, farming, etc. And we're discussing UN climate summit taking place right now in Sharm el-Sheikh, Egypt. And your book you wrote 5 years ago has had enormous durability in terms of just staying like very relevant to people's interest. If you could maybe explain why you think that is. And also, well, do you experience a lot of personal frustration as a scientist when you see the federal government telling you something that you know and understand to be absolutely false? How do you deal with that?
Let's talk with the last one first. I do. I see frustration. What I find is I'm hugely optimistic of what the American population thinks about climate change. I just see on a daily or weekly basis, I talk to a lot of people about this, just random people, not, you know, people of my ilk, but rather just random people at an airport or wherever. And people are thirsty for this information, Scott, this information they've never heard. And I told you that fires were 20% of what they were 90 years ago. People go, what? And I pull out my smartphone app. That's a free smartphone app. You can get it. Just search for Inconvenient Facts to download it. And you can pull out this information and show them the charts showing five times as many fires back in the 20s and 30s as today. Or again, the tornadoes are declining. We don't get a chance to put that information out to the population in a large way because they need to silence us, and they're doing a pretty good job of it. All the mainstream outlets refuse to put any science deniers on the air. They said, well, because the science is settled, there's a consensus and there's no need to discuss it or give another viewpoint. Well, yes, there is. Yes, Virginia, there is a debate, and it's we as scientists, again, at the CO2 Coalition, we paint a pretty good picture with science, data, and facts to push back on this. But to get back to the book was Inconvenient Facts, was published in late 2017. It's been on and off number. It was just 2 weeks ago. It was a number one bestseller in two categories on Amazon, environmental policy and climatology. It's been adopted by as their go-to book and promoted by some pretty big names in the media world, Glenn Beck, Candace Owens, Joe Pags, Scott Wheeler, you know, you're the biggest name of all, but it's really been, these people are promoting the book. And so I've been blessed to meet some really interesting people. And so the book is, it's got legs. And the nice thing about the book is I'm going through and updating it now. We're going to launch our our updated, revised, and expanded version early next year. And in fact, I just had to get it. I thought we were going to be okay. I'm getting a seventh printing of the book that's due at my warehouse shortly. I've only got seven books left in inventory. So if you're thinking about buying, you might want to do soon, because we will probably sell out at some point over the next week or two. That's inconvenient fact. So it's been a blessing, and it's been a lot of fun. But the biggest charge I get are the number of people we've reached and the amount of scientific facts that we're able to get out to the public. And at the CO2 Coalition, another thing that I'm just so proud of what we've done with the education initiative. We're launching a new website we're building. It's called CO2 Learning Center. We've got three books published. They're not available for the public yet. We'll be launching that probably again mid-December, hopefully early December. And we've got books. We've got four videos. If you go to YouTube, go to CO2 Learning Center to see these are marvelous videos. The videos are done anime style. The books are manga, which is a type of similar to anime. The kids just love them. They're really interesting. They're fun. And they can learn things. My granddaughter, just before she turned five, read the first book to me. And she stumbled over photosynthesis and veterinarian. But other than those two words, she did pretty well. And so what we're doing is trying to present science about photosynthesis, about CO2, about solar energy, not the science kind of solar energy that comes in a panel and makes the electricity, but rather the solar energy from the sun. Things like that they're learning about. And we've got the really cool thing. We're preparing lesson plans for each of the books and each of the videos. So homeschoolers, charter schools, maybe public schools could use these lesson plans to teach their children. We want to teach them science without the alarmism. And it's really an uplifting thing we're doing. It's a great, great experience.
We're speaking with Gregory Wrightstone, who is the executive director of the CO2 Coalition, which has an impressive cadre of scientists as that help put this together. In addition to yourself, you've got a lot of people who've been studying this for decades who understand science better than anyone in public, who's making public policy today, clearly. But at the same time, we have this massive disinformation campaign that's being funded by our own government, providing, spending billions of dollars to convince people that there's a problem. And I've sort of, in my own research, have identified part of this as when the government comes to a science department at, say, Harvard or MIT or Columbia, and they offer, a multi-million dollar grant to the department to study the possibility of global warming, and these departments, university departments of science, discover that by finding that it's plausible, which is usually where they all come down, there's a plausible chance that this is true, that it means more money to study it further. And so there's a financial incentive in the science community. Have you seen this also, or do you see it a different way?
Oh, no, absolutely. We know. And the stronger thing, yes, there's that financial incentive, but there's also a strong disincentive to coming out and speaking the truth. We had a recent...
Well, that has happened recently, yeah.
Yeah, we had a recent PhD professor that came to us that wanted to join the coalition. He was up for tenure. And our chairman, Dr. Will Happer, who's emeritus professor of physics at Princeton, and one of probably the smartest man I will ever meet, he advised this professor, he says, don't do it. He says, I will not accept your, I don't want you to be a member. He says, you get your tech, because you will likely, if you do this, you'll likely not get tenure and you're likely going to get fired. You know, get your tenure and then let's talk. That's what they do. And people, we've seen another of our members, Dr. Peter Ridd from Australia, was fired from his position because he studied, he's a Great Barrier Reef expert. And he was saying, no, 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 no. This is in 2016, there was a tremendous bleaching event. They were calling it climate change. And he put it in the long-term perspective. He says, no, these things happen cyclically. It's going to get better. Well, you know what they found last year? 2021 was the largest, or 2022 this year, I guess, is the largest number of area of the Great Barrier Reef covered by coral, larger than any, the records go back, that they're studying, they go back to 1958. And so is anybody talking about that? But he got fired for speaking the truth. Another friend of ours, Susan Crockford, a polar bear expert, got fired from her position at university, again, for speaking the truth about polar bears. She says, they're not endangered. They're definitely not going extinct. They're becoming a problem because there are too many of them. The problem with polar bears is it's quite dangerous to count them. You know, it's a snowy tundra covered with ice and you stand out like a sore thumb. And apparently humans taste a lot like seals because we're on their menu. So it's a difficult and dangerous thing to do, to go out and try and count polar bears. So there's a, we know today there are probably four times as many polar bears as there were back in the early 60s. A lot of that has to do with hunting. Their hunting ban went into effect. And so now they're growing in population. So they're just all the, we see that professors are completely, and they silence us. There's no way I could go speak at a university. I'd love to, even my own university in Pennsylvania, Waynesburg University won't have me, even though I'm one of the better known of their alumni.
This is, we're in this sort of dark age of science at the moment that is so perplexing for, I know it must be much worse for you guys inside the scientific community, but as a journalist covering it, it's reminiscent of the great Ben Stein movie Expelled that he produced about 17, 18 years ago, I believe it was, where he was talking about the number of scientists who were fired from universities simply for saying or signing on to the belief in intelligent design. And they were fired. Some included tenured professors fired. Others didn't receive tenure and were fired over that. And we're seeing this kind of this similar situation now. And so you went from the science department's getting a financial incentive to say, and if you, over the years, watching it closely, you would see that they were hesitant to say, this is true and it's happening. They would say, yeah, it's plausible. Under the model provided, this could happen. There could be a warming and it could cause this and it could do this. Very provisional in terms of science. And now it's gone to, just as you described, people who don't sign on to it, people who object, being fired, not gaining tenure, that kind of punishment, carrot and stick approach. And we could be heading to, I hate to be an alarmist myself, but if we continue on this path, we could be heading for a great disaster, just similar to what we saw over in the Far East, western part of the Far East, where they started banning fertilizers. And
Sri Lanka,
yeah. And let's talk a little bit about that.
No, go ahead.
Well, let me bring up today's, we've got about 5 minutes left. Let's bring up today's report from the UN. The factory farming puts profits ahead of climate and animals. So that they released a statement today, most people around the world claiming that the UN climate Coalition is itself very compassionate to world farming, but that's really not what their policies, the COP27 policies have actually done, is it? You've found something completely the opposite.
Well, no, they want to. Yes, they're demonizing nitrogen. It's most it's there are a number of different nitrogen compounds, but the greenhouse gas is called nitrous oxide, N2O. It's different from NO2, which is nitrogen oxide. So the nitrous oxide is, and that's one of the things that's given off by nitrogen fertilizers. And they're trying to ban nitrogen fertilizers, shut them down. It's a necessary component to farm. And we just yesterday, we published a new paper. It's called Nitrous Oxide and Climate. And we looked, it's fairly detailed and technical. I went through and summarized it. You can go to the CO2coalition.org and just search for nitrous oxide or nitrogen or my name. To come
that's
up with
it. And CO, the number 2, coalition.org. Yes.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. And we found that, according to Will Happer, the doubling of nitrous oxide won't occur for 400 plus years. And when that does occur, it will only lead to you're sitting down, Scott, I hope, 600ths of a degree of warming. 600, you can't even measure that. That's why they want to shut down nitrogen fertilizers. That's why they want people to go hungry, because crops don't do so well. There are a number of things they need. Photosynthesis requires water, carbon dioxide, and sunlight, but they also need other nutrients to grow to their full potential. Nitrogen's one of those. And it's going to lead, we saw what happened in Sri Lanka, where their agricultural based economy collapsed because they banned fertilizer in 2021. Let's just go green. No, you're going to go hungry. Go green, go hungry. Those type of things of organic farming are just fine for a certain niche. If you want to grow organic crops, not use fertilizer, okay, but they're going to be a lot more expensive. It's not going to grow as well. And to feed the entire world's population, we need things like nitrogen fertilizer. And then
create a food shortage crisis.
Yeah.
Where you've got, just as you pointed out earlier, you've got masses, especially in Africa and the Middle East and the Far East, you've got mass starvation, while at the same time, the UN and the United States, for that matter, are putting pressure on these countries to cut out nitrogen fertilizer, the very thing that helps produce an abundance of crops. We've mm-hmm. spent the past few minutes speaking with Gregory Wrightstone. He is the executive director of the CO2 Coalition, one of the most respected organizations in terms of science and the environment. And he also is the author of the book, Inconvenient Facts. And I recommend everyone look it up and find it and order it. It's an outstanding book. Mr. Wrightstone, thanks so much for joining us from Washington, D.C. This is Scott Wheeler signing off.